If you travel a lot for work or for vacation, you might be familiar with that feeling you get knowing you're leaving your space unused for long periods of time and you're still paying for that privilege. But hosting on Airbnb means you don't have to leave your home sitting empty when you're away. Being an Airbnb host isn't just a way to earn some extra cash. It's a chance to share your space and make a guest's vacation all the more memorable. You might be thinking, maybe my place isn't the right fit, but don't write it off just yet. Your potential Airbnb might be right in front of you. Whether it's a spare room or even your entire home, there's an opportunity waiting. Airbnb turns your home into a practical and even profitable venture. We just got back from a family trip to Hawaii where we stayed in a great Airbnb, but our place back home could have been a highlight to somebody else's travels, and we could have used the extra cash to help pay for the trip. So if you're curious about hosting on Airbnb, find out how much your space could be worth by visiting airbnb.com/host. Once again, that's airbnb.com/host. $3.2 million last year selling other people's stuff on Amazon. What's up, Nick Loper here. Welcome to the Side Hustle Show, part of the Entrepreneur Podcast Network, where we've been making day jobs optional since 2013. Now, one of the core ideas of the show over the last 600 episodes is to go where the cash is already flowing. And nowhere, arguably, is it flowing faster than on Amazon. The e-com giant posted an average of $1.5 billion a day in revenue last year. $1.5 billion in revenue a day in 2023. And today's episode is about how to carve out a piece of that for yourself. And it's not even going to take a big sliver of that pie to make a meaningful income stream for you. Today's guest has done just that over the last 5 years, starting as a side hustle with a unique lower risk e-commerce approach from CoreyGhanim.com. Corey Ghanim, welcome to the Side Hustle Show.
Thank you, Nick. Yeah, man, looking forward to chopping it up and giving your audience a lot of really good insight into how the wholesale business model works on Amazon.
Well, I am looking forward to learning alongside the audience as well. Stick around in this one. We're talking niche and product selection. We're talking about how to find reliable suppliers and the logistics and marketing best practices here that come into play when you're moving millions of dollars in physical inventory around the country. If you're new to the show, welcome. We've got hundreds of killer case studies just like this one. Of course, we'd love to have you binge on the entire archive, but what might make a little more sense is to grab your personalized playlist based on those side hustles that you're most interested in. To generate yours, all you got to do is go to hustle.show, answer a few short multiple choice questions, and then you can add those curated episodes to your device. So Corey, you're playing around with retail arbitrage, online arbitrage, basically buy low from one store or one resource and then selling higher on Amazon. Simple, easy to understand business model, but can be difficult to source consistent inventory. And then you stumble across this wholesale model. You say, well, maybe this could be systemized a little bit better. Talk to me about the origin story here.
Those two methods that you described, retail arbitrage and online arbitrage, are the lowest barrier to entry, easiest ways to get started selling on Amazon. That's exactly how I got started. Now, this was late 2018. I was getting a little burned out on the online arbitrage hustle because it's exactly that. It's a hustle. There's not a lot of replenishable products that you can find. You're always looking for your next product. Now, I stumbled upon a YouTube video where a large wholesale seller at the time, I think he was doing about 8 figures per year, and this was back in 2018. The YouTube video was just him with a Google Doc where he breaks down the wholesale business model with a couple of easy numbers, right? So the way that he described it in this video is he said, okay, let's say you've got $5,000 in capital to invest in inventory. You spend that $5,000 on profitable inventory. 60-ish days later, after you've sold through the inventory and you get paid by Amazon, now you've got $6,000. So you just turn $5,000 into $6,000.
Yeah.
You take that $6,000, you spend it on profitable inventory, and let's say it comes back as $7,200. It was just very obvious to me the compounding effect that this business provides, the kind of the snowball effect where if you buy good inventory, you sell it, you're just going to compound your money pretty quickly. And that is when the light bulb kind of turned on for me. And I said, whoa, I need to dip my feet into this model because it seemed a lot more scalable, which it is. And couple that with the fact that to really succeed in wholesale, it is a sales business, right? You're having to sell suppliers on why they should work with you. You're having to negotiate. You're having to follow up. All of these things that fit my skill set, because I was a full-time IT sales professional at the time. So to me, this just seemed like the best approach. And that's kind of when I really went deep into that business model right at the beginning of 2019.
And it seemed like one of the biggest differentiating factors is that word you mentioned, like this replenishable nature of it, where I can keep going back to the well of those same suppliers once I have that relationship set up with them. So I don't have to reinvent the wheel or go hunting for that next profitable product every single time. And that was, you know, when I was doing retail arbitrage, like that was kind of the, I kind of like that needle in the haystack treasure hunt feel of it. Like you it's never fun. Knew what you were going to find going into that store. But at the same time, there were times where you'd spend 45 minutes in the Walmart or the Home Depot and walk out empty handed. You're like, wow, shoot, there's probably something better I should have been doing with that time. And so here's a way, potentially lower margins, I'm guessing, but maybe more consistent and more scalable.
Yeah, absolutely. And so also just to kind of clear the air on something. So you did mention those replenishable products. Now, wholesale definitely gives you the opportunity to find products that you can carry on a long-term basis. I mean, our longest running product we bought for, I think, over 3 years consistently, where all we had to do was send a purchase order to our supplier, ship it into Amazon, and just make sales on repeat for 3 years straight. That said, every product has a life cycle. So there's some products where we buy it once, and let's say the price tanks for whatever reason, and that product is no longer replenishable. So I like to look at the wholesale business as your inventory is like your portfolio of products, just like you'd have an investment portfolio. There's going to be some products and some investments that perform better, some that perform worse, and sometimes you got to prune your portfolio to make room for other better products.
That makes sense because you got a lot of capital tied up in inventory. You want to make sure that inventory is turning. And if it is turning, that you're making a margin on it. So that makes sense.
Exactly.
So if you're coaching me and I'm at Amazon.com, like I'm on the homepage, like, or is that where my product research starts? Where do I even begin to figure out what kind of products, companies, brands, industry, like what makes a good wholesale product or where should I start?
I've really boiled down like the wholesale process to just three very simple criteria as far as what we look for when sourcing a wholesale product. So I want to find products that have existing FBA competition, meaning other sellers are already selling it. Now, I'm going to dig into that first criteria first, because some people listening to this might be thinking, well, wait, why would I want competition? Why would I want there to be competition on the products that I'm selling? Well, the idea is if there's competition, that means those other sellers have already validated that product, right? If they're selling it, that means they're buying it at a profitable price from somewhere, which means that we probably can too, right? So okay. That's the first criteria.
How do you determine other seller? Like this would be like under the buy box where it says like also available from, how do you figure out how many people are selling it?
Yeah, exactly. So that's one way to do it, right? And there's also a very handy, completely free Chrome extension that I've used since day one. I've been using this for years. It's called DS Amazon Quick View. It's free in the Chrome store. You attach it to your Google Chrome. And what it'll show you when you're on a search results page on Amazon, it'll just pop up under each listing telling you, hey, either Amazon is selling this product themselves, or there's say X amount of other third-party sellers selling it. You see what I mean? So if DS Amazon Quick View tells me that there's competition on this listing, then that checks that box.
Okay, because it'll say something like sold by Corey LLC, fulfilled by Amazon or something.
Yeah, or it'll really just say the number of other sellers on that listing. So it might say 3 sellers or 10 sellers. Or it'll say, like I said, sold by Amazon, which we can get into that criteria further, but I typically avoid competing directly against Amazon because, as you and I know, Amazon only cares about offering the customer the lowest price, and they're willing to take a loss on a product just to get the customer the best price. So I've been in situations where I'm competing directly with Amazon and they're selling at below my buy cost. Yeah, so I've either got to liquidate and take a big loss or hold my price high and just hope and pray that Amazon runs out of stock. Now, if you do your research properly, you're going to avoid that situation most of the time. But okay, that is a legitimate pitfall that happens in this business.
Okay. Avoiding products that are only being sold by Amazon, you want to see some other sellers into the mix because that's the Bezos line of, well, your margin is my opportunity. And so, yeah.
Right. Exactly.
We'll squeeze you down to zero on that. Okay. So looking for existing competition. What's next on this criteria?
So we actually kind of did just touch on that second criteria. Second criteria is I want to make sure that the product is not dominated by Amazon. I just don't want to compete directly with Amazon. Now, the third and final criteria is I just want to make sure that there's some demand for that product already. Now, there are plenty of third-party tools out there that'll give you an estimate for how many units a product is selling per month. But I don't know if you've noticed, really, this is new as of the last few months. On the listing page itself, Amazon now tells you how many units a product is selling roughly, right? Have you seen that badge where it'll say 500 bought in the last month or 50 bought in the last
month? Yeah. I thought that was a really interesting kind of like social proof, I imagine, A-B test of what they're experimenting with on the product pages to say, well, shoot, if 500 other people bought, there's safety in numbers, well, maybe I ought to buy it too. And of course, the business mind is like, dang, if they're selling 500 a month at this price, Okay, so there's some tools like Jungle Scout has been mentioned on the show in the past, like their estimator tool. But in some listings, you might be able to see it publicly on that product page.
Exactly. The two tools that I mentioned thus far, DS Amazon Quick View, and just the listing page itself where Amazon tells you the sales, that's completely free. So you don't need to even have any paid software to validate a particular product, right? You can pull up any old product listing, run them through those three criteria. And if those three boxes are checked, then the next step is, okay, well, how do I source that product? And we can get into that if you'd like.
I would love to get into sourcing. But first, do you have any advice? Because there's millions and millions of products, like just to even start to, are there categories that you like that are newbie friendly? Or do you start, well, what are your hobbies or interests? Like you got to go where you know first. So look for ski gear or biking gear or something like that.
So you kind of hit the nail on the head, right? And Amazon can be massively overwhelming because there are, don't quote me on this, but there's something like 32 categories of products on Amazon. And there are, no exaggeration, tens of thousands of subcategories under those main categories. So my advice to newer sellers is, like you said, go with what you know, right? If you're a car enthusiast, well, chances are you're probably going to find a lot of opportunities in that automotive category because you probably recognize some of the brand names and you know what the parts are and you know what a good price point looks like for certain products. You know what I mean? So that's my first piece of advice is go with what you know. However, regardless of how you approach it, I always recommend people go niche, right? Because I do have some people tell me, well, Corey, I don't really have any hobbies or anything in particular that I know that well. Where do I start? My advice to that person is choose a category, right? So let's use that same example, automotive. Choose a category, automotive, and then find a subcategory within automotive that you can start to learn, right? So for example, spark plugs. You'd be surprised how many different brands of spark plugs exist and how many of those brands are actually selling really well on Amazon. If you're brand new to Amazon and you don't really have any big interests or big hobbies that you know a lot about, choose a main category, choose a subcategory, and start learning the brands and the products within that subcategory.
Yeah, I feel like there's a huge breadth of products. You could spend a lot of time on this just a research phase, trying to find something that checks these boxes. Existing FBA seller competition, not sold directly or dominated by Amazon, and some level of existing demand sales per month. I forgot to ask, is there a minimum threshold you're trying to get on that sales per month criteria?
I'm usually hesitant to give a hard number and say like, oh, it's got to be doing 50 sales a month or 200 sales a month. And the reason I don't really give a hard number is because everybody's business and everybody's experience level is different. So if you're a brand new seller, I just want you to make a sale, right? And you might be perfectly fine selling, say, 10 units per month of a product, right? Whereas myself, as a seasoned seller, I might not settle for a product that's selling less than, say, 200 units per month. So that's why the caveat that I usually give people is it's got to be selling well. And I say well in quotations because it's essentially got to be selling well enough to be worth your time.
Yeah, it's relative.
You're in your business.
Okay, that's fair. More with Corey in just a moment, including the distributor outreach strategy and script that sets him apart from other resellers and how to calculate your estimated profit potential for each product right after this. When you're hiring, it feels amazing to finally close out a job search and hit the ground running with your new hire. But what if you could get rid of the search part and just get matched with qualified candidates? Well, now you can with our sponsor, Indeed. It's simple. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. The matching and hiring platform is trusted by over 3.5 million businesses worldwide to connect with great talent faster. And 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. For my next hire, I'm using Indeed to tap into a talent pool of 350 million unique monthly visitors. And what else is cool is Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use it, the better it gets. And how about this? Side Hustle Show listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Side Hustle Show. Just go to Indeed.com/Side Hustle Show right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Side Hustle Show. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. This edition of The Side Hustle Show is sponsored by Squarespace. You probably already know that Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, but it turns out Squarespace is a lot more than just a pretty website builder. For example, did you know that Squarespace has a new AI-guided design system called Squarespace Blueprint? I was playing around with this the other day. It's pretty slick and might be the fastest way to get a professionally curated layout tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Did you know that Squarespace can also host your online course? You can create the lessons that your audience is going to love, then you add your paywall and set the price. You can charge a one-time fee, you can sell subscriptions, and you can customize the whole thing to fit your brand. And finally, flexible payment options. Whether you're selling a course or a digital product or a physical product or your own services, Squarespace makes checkout seamless for your customers by letting you accept credit cards, PayPal and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, you can even offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. So head on over to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/sidehustle to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. All right. So say we find these spark plugs that meet the criteria, and then you find out who makes them, who's a distributor for them. Like, where do you even go from there?
The lowest hanging fruit is going to be to go directly to the manufacturer. Now, this is going to be the easiest approach when it's not like a big, massive international brand, right? So I'm not talking about going directly to like Procter & Gamble or like Unilever, right? The brands that I'm talking about are going to be those small to maybe medium-sized brands that you probably never heard of. But when you look on Amazon, they're selling $10, $50, $100,000 per month across the whole brand on Amazon. So honestly, Nick, it's as simple as Googling the company name. 99% of companies are going to have a website. They're going to have a contact us form on their website. And I prefer to call because most sellers like to email and I like to stand out. So I just find that contact us page on their website. I call up the phone number. I have a script that I use pretty much every time that I can share if you'd like.
Yeah. We love it. Go ahead.
Okay, perfect. I call up the number. Usually it's a 1-800 number. A lot of times it's an automated answering type of message that you hear. And my goal is to get in touch with somebody in sales. Sometimes it's as simple as, well, press 2 to be forwarded to the sales department, which then I just press 2. Sometimes you're routed to, let's say, a secretary, right? So my line might be, hey, my name's Corey Ganim. I own a retail business. We're located here in Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm really looking to purchase some of your products for resale in our business. I'd love to get in touch with somebody in your sales department. Do you mind forwarding me to the salesperson that covers Charlotte, North Carolina? Literally simple as that. And they will say, well, sure. Yeah, that's Mike. I'll put you right over to Mike. Now, this is a tough part, Nick. A lot of times, to use that same example, if Mike's my sales rep, well, Mike's busy. He's talking to other customers or he's got a million other things going on. So I'd say probably 50% of the time, I'm not going to get in touch with Mike right then and there. So I've got to be diligent in following up with Mike the 2, 5, 10, 50 times it might take to get in touch with him. And I'm not exaggerating. I can go into how long I followed up with some people before because it's been a long time.
Yeah. There's some parallels here. I was cold calling, trying to sell paint jobs in college. And there's almost like this level of psyching myself up in the truck, finally get up the nerve to go knock on that first door. And nobody was home. I'm like, okay,
right.
Let's go over the pitch, go over the spiel in my head one more time. And they got to the point toward the end of the summer where you start knocking on doors 2-3 times. And sometimes you forget what house is. Dude, you were here like a month ago. Like, it's fine. We're good. We don't. But it's like, yeah, right. Trying to do that follow up because you never know who's going to be home at what time. But be diligent about that follow up. I had a question. It was related to, okay, trying to find these brands that it's not the Nikes or Procter & Gamble's of the world, but some brand that's selling well on Amazon that isn't a household name yet. But are they selling their stuff directly? Or if they're not, like, why aren't they? Like, why are they dealing with resellers like you?
That's probably one of the most common questions I get from people that are skeptical about this model, right? They think, well, Corey, this is great, but why wouldn't the brand just sell on Amazon themselves? Or why wouldn't they just sell directly to Amazon? Now, the answer for that is because 90 to 95% of brands are clueless when it comes to Amazon. They know that they've got to exist on Amazon because that's where the customers are. But as far as doing that the right way, they have no idea. Their skill set lies in creating and manufacturing really good products and building their brand. Their skill set does not lie in selling on Amazon. Because, I mean, Nick, you've done retail arbitrage. You and I know that Amazon is an entirely separate skill set. It's an entirely different beast from anything else out there. So it just makes way more sense for these brands to partner with resellers like myself who understand Amazon as a platform and allow us to essentially represent their products on Amazon. It's not like they're missing out on that revenue because we're buying from them at wholesale pricing and then we're just turning around and selling on Amazon at retail. You see what I mean? So that way the brand still captures all of those sales, but they're doing it via a third-party seller like us that has their interest at heart.
If they're already selling on Amazon, I mean, that's how you kind of came across them in the first place, through other sellers. Is it a net needle mover to add another reseller to the mix? It's like, well, the throughput volume is going to be the same. We're just going to divide that pie up into smaller slices.
This is where your sales and negotiation skills will come in handy, right? So if you're a brand new seller, I don't expect you to know how to actually grow a brand sales on Amazon, right? If you're a brand new seller, I just want you to get your first product. And some brands, Nick, don't care about adding another reseller. They just want to make a sale. So there are some brands out there that are willing to further divide that slice of the pie to add another reseller. Now, those are going to be some low-hanging fruit for some newer sellers. However, the best brands, the ones that are the most profitable, that are doing the most volume, that everybody wants to sell, are going to be very selective with who they allow to represent them on Amazon. In fact, most of them are going to deny you. They're going to flat out deny you because they'll say something like, well, we already have our set number of Amazon resellers. Or like you said, we don't want to just cut the pie further. We want somebody to come expand the pie. Now, that's where that Amazon expertise and that skill set comes in. Because if you can show them how, hey, if you allow me to be an authorized reseller of your products on Amazon, I'm not just going to piggyback on your existing sales. I'm not just going to cut another slice out of the pie. I'm going to grow the total size of the pie. So that way there's more to go around. Does that make sense? And there are certain levers you can pull and certain things that you can do to actually fulfill on that promise and grow their sales, not just piggyback on what they've already created. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I can see how down the road, as you develop that Amazon sales expertise, how to create better listing pages and all that jazz, then the sales can grow and you can demonstrate that. Your point about their goal is to sell their product. They're going to make their margin selling to you, and whether or not it's sell, like, obviously they want to keep that relationship and keep selling more and more. So it's in everyone's interest to grow that pie, like you said. So let's say you get Mike on the phone at the Spark Plug place. What's the conversation like? You say, hey, I want to be a reseller for your product. So most of the time he's going to reject you. Now we're good. We already got our Rolodex of Amazon distributors. Like, what happens from that call if you start to get some interest?
So the best way to approach suppliers, now whether you're going directly to the brand or whether you're buying through a distributor, regardless of who you're buying from, there's going to be a correct way to approach them and an incorrect way, right? So the worst possible way to talk to either a brand owner or a supplier of any sort is to say something along the lines of, hey, I'm Corey, I'm an Amazon seller, I want to buy some of your products, can you send me over your pricing?
That's the wrong way.
Correct, that's the wrong way. 99 times, I'd even say 900 times out of 1,000, you're going to get either hung up on, they're going to say something very rude to you. Like, because listen, most of these brands are getting contacted by 50 people per week looking to do exactly what I just said, and they're sick of hearing it. And the reason that they don't like Amazon sellers is because Amazon sellers are notorious for being poor communicators, for not being serious business owners, right? That brand owners picture Amazon sellers as a guy in their basement looking to make a quick buck flipping products, right? So the way that we reframe that approach is by being very specific and telling them exactly what we want. So being specific and being concise. So instead of saying, hey, Mike, I'm Corey, I'm an Amazon seller, I'd like to sell your products, can you send me your pricing? I would do a little bit of upfront research before that call. I'm talking like 2 to 3 minutes, not 30 minutes. And all I want to know is, all right, when I talk to Mike, what products specifically do I want to buy? So that way I can show him I'm serious. So when I call up Mike, I say, hey, Mike, I'm Corey Ganim. I own a retail business. I know you get these calls every week, so I'll make it quick. I have 3 products specifically from your brand that I'm looking to purchase. I know the exact quantities that I want to buy, and I have a price in mind that I'm willing to pay. So if we can come to an agreement on that price point, then I can get you a purchase order today. So would you mind sending me over your dealer application? Right? So you see how that's an entirely separate approach, because in Mike's mind, when he hears that second approach, he's like, okay, well, this guy knows what he wants. He knows the quantity that he wants. Sounds like he's serious. He told me he can get me a PO today. Okay, maybe it's worth a shot. And that takes your chances from 1% to now maybe 30 to 50%.
Okay, yeah, significant improvement for sure.
Yeah.
Well, let's say you get a yes, and now you're on the hook to send over that purchase order. Like, what does that look like? If I'm a brand new seller, like, oh shoot, like I wasn't prepared for that. Now I got to figure out how to make this look official right away.
The beautiful part of that approach is, notice how I said, well, hey, if we can come to an agreement on pricing, quantity, those types of things, then I can get you an order. I'm not just saying, hey, I'm going to send you a purchase order, even if you're charging me retail price. That's not what I'm saying at all. So at that point, it becomes a conversation of, okay, let me fill out your application. Let me get a look at your pricing so that I can go back to my team, or what, if you don't have a team, you could just say, I can go back to my workstation and put that order together for you. I'll have it over to you before the end of the day, right? And now let's say Mike sends you pricing that's just way out of whack. It's not going to work. It's not profitable. You know, you can't place that order. That's when you start that negotiation process. That's when I would call Mike and say, hey, Mike, I just got your pricing. Appreciate you getting that over to me. Unfortunately, based on the pricing that you guys are offering me, I'm just not going to be able to be competitive based on the pricing on Amazon that I'm seeing at the moment. So with that being said, do you guys offer any sort of quantity discounts? Is there a certain amount that I would need to buy in order to get, say, a 10% off, right? That's when you start to dangle that carrot in front of him. I'm like, listen, Mike, I'd love to buy. I'm ready to buy. But at the current pricing, it just doesn't make sense. You see?
How are you calculating the price that you need to get it at based on, you can see the public sales price on Amazon, but then you got to back out the stocking fees, all this other stuff that's going to eat into that margin. So talk to me about how you need to think about pricing and where you need to be at on the purchase side.
The tool that I use to do that is called SellerAmp, and it's just selleramp.com. The starting pricing is like $20 a month. So it's a super cheap tool. And what that is it's also a Chrome extension. It'll essentially pops up a tool on the Amazon listing page where all I have to do is enter my buy cost into SellerAmp, and it shows me my profit that's going to be left over after accounting for all of Amazon's fees.
Oh, that's really cool. Okay.
Yeah. So I can just take Mike's, if Mike gives me pricing, I can literally copy his price, paste it into SellerAmp, and SellerAmp might say, well, hey, you're going to lose $2, or hey, this is a $6 profit and you're at a 30% ROI. Great. Well, hey, Mike, here's the purchase order.
Yeah. How many can I get? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, that's super helpful. Is there a minimum either percentage margin or dollar margin that makes things interesting or make things worthwhile for you?
You'll hear a lot of debate on this, like among the Amazon seller community. You'll hear people say, well, I won't buy anything for less than a 30% ROI, or I've got to have a 15% margin, right? So my opinion on profitability is I like to look at products from the lens of how much profit is this going to make me per month? Because when I look at monthly dollar profit instead of like ROI or margin, then that pretty much factors all of those things in, right? So if I know that I only buy products and I'm expecting to make, say, $250 in profit per month, then if I can do the math based on estimated sales times my dollar profit per unit, if that's greater than 250, then I buy it. If it's less than 250, I don't. You see what I mean?
Are you estimating your monthly sales based on that? Well, Amazon publicly said it was selling 500 units a month, or you have to kind of divide that by the 10 sellers that are on that listing?
You actually have to divide it by the the number of competitive sellers on the listing. So that's a mistake that a lot of sellers make, is they'll look at that listing and say, well, this listing's selling 500 units a month, but there's 20 sellers on it. So I'm only going to sell, I don't do math publicly, but
sure, a fraction of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever that number is. So, but what people need to realize is that just because there's 20 sellers on that listing doesn't mean that all 20 sellers are getting an equal share of those sales, right? You want to be looking at competitive sellers. Now, competitive seller to me is any seller that is priced within 2% of the buy box. And tools like SellerAmp will tell you the number of competitive sellers. So to use that same example, instead of dividing by just the 20 total sellers, of those 20, there might only be 5 that are competitive. So that way, instead of dividing 500 by 20, okay, I'm dividing 500 by 5. You see what I mean?
Okay. And say I can reasonably expect to sell 100 of these.
Exactly.
Okay. Do you find that as more and more sellers get into the game, that there's a natural downward pressure on price as people like start to freak out? I'm sitting on all this inventory. I just want to move it. And so one person undercuts the next guy by 5 cents, and the next person undercuts that, and you like see this race to the bottom.
Listen, that definitely happens. And now that is going to be super common with arbitrage, right? When we talk online arbitrage or retail arbitrage, you hear all the horror stories of, well, I thought I was going to make a $30 profit and now I'm losing $5, right? So that very common in an arbitrage business. It happens in a wholesale business, but if you do your research properly, you really limit your downside. So another tool that we use, it's called Keepa. It'll basically show you the competition on that listing over time. So Keepa will show me the number of sellers on that listing. And as long as that level of competition is not like rapidly increasing, then I know that demand's going to be relatively the same, supply is going to be relatively the same, therefore price is going to be relatively the same. Now, if I looked at Keepa and I say, well, okay, last week there was 10 sellers on this listing, now there's 15 sellers on that listing, well, that means competition just went up by 50% and price has got to come down. It's supply and demand at the end of the day. So without getting too much into the weeds, there are some pretty simple tools that we use to tell us with a pretty high level of estimation whether that price is going to come down or whether it's going to be relatively steady.
Is that the biggest risk that you see? Just like making a big order and having it be unprofitable or having the price kind of get cut out from under you?
That is definitely going to be one of the bigger risks, especially for newer sellers. Because listen, if you're a newer seller, you're going to make those mistakes. I mean, I still make those mistakes, right? Because some situations you just can't predict and it happens, which is why I always recommend, if it's the first time you're buying a particular product or a particular brand, you want to place what I call a test order, right? So a test order is going to be anywhere from, let's say, 1 to 2 weeks worth of inventory. We know what 1 to 2 weeks worth of inventory is using that SellerAmp sales estimation tool that I mentioned. So instead of buying 2 months worth of product, I'm going to buy 2 weeks worth of product. And worst case scenario, absolute worst case, I might break even or lose a dollar or two per unit, not the end of the world. Best case, it sells well. Now I got to go back and buy more.
Okay. More with Corey in just a moment, including how much of his $3.2 million in sales last year was actually profit and what new Amazon sellers should know about startup costs, licenses, and logistics right after this. If you travel a lot for work or for vacation, you might be familiar with that feeling you get knowing you're leaving your space unused for long periods of time and you're still paying for that privilege. But hosting on Airbnb means you don't have to leave your home sitting empty when you're away. Being an Airbnb host isn't just a way to earn some extra cash. It's a chance to share your space and make a guest's vacation all the more memorable. You might be thinking, maybe my place isn't the right fit, but don't write it off just yet. Your potential Airbnb might be right in front of you. Whether it's a spare room or even your entire home, there's an opportunity waiting. Airbnb turns your home into a practical and even profitable venture. We just got back from a family trip to Hawaii where we stayed in a great Airbnb, but our place back home could have been a highlight to somebody else's travels, and we could have used the extra cash to help pay for the trip. So if you're curious about hosting on Airbnb, find out how much your space could be worth by visiting airbnb.com/host. Once again, that's airbnb.com/host. Are you looking for your next business venture? It's so easy to get started in vending, and the possibilities of what you can sell are pretty much endless. Snacks and drinks, electronics, personal care items, you name it, you can probably vend it. And what's great about getting started in the vending game is this: no degree required, just your own hustle. And our sponsor, Cantaloupe, can help you easily start a vending business and earn some passive income. Cantaloupe connects you with the right suppliers and partners to get started. They equip you with the technology to collect credit card and mobile payments right out of the gate, and they provide free software that helps you manage your business from day one. So join the more than 30,000 entrepreneurs who rely on Cantaloupe to run and grow their vending businesses every single day. To get started, visit cantaloupe.com/sidehustle. That's cantaloupe like the fruit, cantaloupe.com/sidehustle. And big thanks to Cantaloupe for sponsoring the show.
So of the 3.2 million from last year, like how much shakes out to the bottom line?
Historically, our net margin in our business is like 4.8% about their lifetime. So, but that being said, I have a virtual team. So I've got virtual assistants. We use prep centers to do all of our shipping and handle all of our logistics. And the reason I bring this up is a large portion of our business is outsourced and there's costs associated with that.
Yeah. And you're paying yourself. Well, before. Right.
Exactly. So my personal salary is factored into our operating expenses. So with my salary included, we're at about a 4.8% net margin. Now, I did the math recently. If I were to not pay myself a salary, if I were just to keep that profit in the business, our net margin would be closer to about 8%. So a healthy wholesale business is operating in the 5 to 8% net margin range. A wholesale business that's doing 10% net is crushing it. And it's probably not very big because at scale, seven figures or multiple seven figures per year, you're going to be doing about 5 to 8% net, assuming you're taking a good salary.
Yeah. You know, coming from like the online content business world where you're like, shoot, 80%, 90% margin months, I'm like, ooh, 5 to 10, like that seems real thin. But to your point, it's like, well, it's less about that percentage than it is about the actual dollars at the end of the month. And as that grows, you're like, yeah, I would still, if I'm trading $100 for $105, like, okay, lather, rinse, repeat. If I could do that predictably and reliably, I'll do that all day. So that's really helpful to know and appreciate your transparency on all of that. Cause I think people will naturally be curious. Yeah, it's easy to post a big revenue number, but what, you know, how much are you actually making? So that's really cool.
That's a reason too, why like people that are familiar with the Amazon space, they call them orange bars, right? Because in your Amazon seller app, it shows your sales in a graph format. And those graphs are portrayed as orange bars. And so a very common skeptical thing that people say in the industry is, well, forget about the orange bars. What's your profit? Yeah. And I agree with that completely, which is why you never really see me on my social media posting my revenue or my orange bars, because I've been around long enough to know that that means nothing, right? It's all about profit.
What was shocking to me was the speed at which inventory turned. I approached retail arbitrage as kind of skeptical. Like in the era of big data, how does Walmart have profitable arbitrage products sitting on its shelves? Like, why wouldn't they just send it into Amazon? But sure enough, there they were, sent them in. And like within a day of hitting the warehouse, like they were sold. And I was like, oh, you sold $120-something yesterday. It's like, really? Like how that stuff must have just landed. And as soon as it hit, it was gone. I was like, dang, okay, this is real. Like it was really eye-opening from that standpoint. But that was orange bars. It's like, okay, well, you had to pay X for that inventory. So you minus out whatever the actual profit was on that. I wanted to ask about typical startup costs, like for this 1 to 2 weeks worth of inventory, test order. What's typical? What are you seeing for new wholesalers getting into it?
My advice is going to be 5 to 10K in capital for inventory. Now, again, that's for inventory. So if you plan on buying a course or if you plan on any sort of information to kind of help you get started, that's going to be separate. Right? So 5 to 10K for inventory. Now, with that said, you don't, nor should you, spend all of that money on one order or on one product or even with one supplier. Let's say you're starting off with 5K for inventory. Well, I'd love to see you spend $500 to $1,000 at a time, right? So take that 5K, spread it out among, let's say, five different suppliers, five different purchase orders, and let's say 5 to 10 products per order. You see what I mean? So you've got 5K spread over, let's say, 50 different products. So that way, because some inevitably won't do well, well, you cut the losers, you double down on the winners, and then you find more winners, right? It's a very simple business at the end of the day. It's just a repetition game. And it's a game of how quickly can I make mistakes so that I can not make those mistakes in the future and move forward.
Okay, so you get the pricing that looks good. You plugged it into the tool. You're like, okay, I'm going to make my desired sales per unit and estimate this much per month. You send over the purchase order. Did they send the product to you? Did they send it directly to the Amazon warehouse? Where do you send this stuff?
That is going to be the second half of the equation, right? The first half is going to be finding the supplier, finding the products. Second half is, well, now I got to get it to Amazon. There's two ways to actually sell on Amazon. There's FBM, which stands for Fulfilled by Merchant. And think of FBM as kind of how you would sell on eBay. If I have a product that I'm fulfilling by merchant, if a customer buys it from me, I'm packing up that individual product and I'm shipping it to that individual customer. That's like the eBay model. Now, you also have what's called FBA, or Fulfilled by Amazon, where I get all my inventory, right? I buy products and I ship all of them to Amazon upfront in bulk. Now, when Amazon receives them, that's when the customers have the ability to buy them from me. And when a customer buys a product from me, Amazon then fulfills each individual order to that customer. You see what I mean? So with FBA, we're doing all of our shipping upfront in bulk. Our FBA products qualify for Prime.
Yes, you pay higher fees in exchange for that, but the customer, you see a higher conversion rate because it's Prime eligible and you only had to touch it once. You're not making trips to the post office.
Exactly. So FBA is going to be a little more expensive in terms of fees, but significantly worth it, right? My business is 100% FBA. But that doesn't answer your question of, well, how do I get these products to Amazon? So when I started my business, and this is how I recommend everybody else start, is I order from my supplier ships to me. It's okay if I'm operating out of my garage. It's okay if I'm operating out of my basement. 90% of suppliers won't care. You might need to let them know and say, hey, you're going to be shipping to a residential address, which might be a little bit of a shipping upcharge, but they don't care. So they ship it to your house or your basement or wherever you are. And like I said, you turn around, you throw them into boxes, you slap labels on the boxes, and you send them off to Amazon.
Okay, because they're going to want it probably sent to several different distribution centers.
Yep, more than likely Amazon's going to split that shipping up. Previously, before March 1st, most of our stuff would just go to one location. So it was easy. We could throw it in one box or one pallet or whatever and just send it to one place. But now Amazon is splitting stuff up, right? Amazon might tell me, well, hey, Corey, I know you used to send all your stuff to this one warehouse. Well, now we want you to send it to these four warehouses. So it's going to be four times the effort on my part, which sucks. But that's the name of the game. Amazon is constantly adapting. That change probably got a lot of people to quit, which means there's only more room for people that are going to roll with the punches and implement those changes.
Fair. Yeah. You plan in somebody else's sandbox. You got to deal with the rules changes as they come.
Yep, exactly.
Okay. So if you're starting out, it comes to you, you box it up, send it in to the different warehouses that tell you through sellercentral.amazon.com, set up your account over there where it needs to go. Do you need to do anything like labeling wise, like barcode wise, or is it like it's coming, hopefully coming that way from the manufacturer, from the distributor?
So you will be required to put basically an individual barcode on each individual unit. So if I buy, let's say, 100 units of a product from my supplier, when they get to me, I've got to put an individual label on each unit. So I'm going to have to put 100 labels, right? And then I'm going to have to put them in a box. And then I'm just going to have to put a special box label on that box. So that way, Amazon knows when Amazon gets it in their fulfillment center, all they have to do is scan that label and they know exactly what's in that box. And that box label, you literally just print from within your Seller Central account. So it's not like I got to go like looking for that label.
Okay. Are there any reseller licenses, regulatory requirements, ungating requirements? This is a big thing in online arbitrage, for example. I can't sell in this category unless I'm ungated. And to do that, I need three invoices across. It's like kind of this became kind of a pain to get that stuff done. And here you're like, no, I legit have an invoice from a brand or from a distributor. Any other things on the upfront red tape side of things?
The only things that you truly need to get started, like to actually place orders, is you need a business entity, right? Which for 99% of people is going to be an LLC. I'm not an accountant. I'm not an attorney. I would verify that first. but more than likely it's going to be an LLC. Once you have your LLC, you're going to get what's called an EIN number, and you can get that for free in 30 seconds on the IRS website. And now your EIN number, think of your EIN as the social security number for your business, right? That's all that is. And then you're going to open a business bank account, which you need an EIN number to do. And once you have those three things, you're good to go to start buying at wholesale from these B2B, business-to-business suppliers. There is one consideration as far as not paying sales tax on those purchases that you're making. So as a reseller, we don't pay sales tax because our customers, the end customer on Amazon, is the one paying that sales tax. So in most states, now it varies state by state, you'll be required to register with your state's Department of Revenue as a retailer. And when you do that, you will get what is called, now it has a million different terms, but it's essentially a reseller certificate, or some places call it a resale license, right? It has like 5 to 10 different names, but and it varies by state, but you will get that document. You provide that document to your supplier before you buy. And when your supplier gets that document from you, they say, okay, Corey is licensed with the state as a reseller. His customer is going to pay the sales tax, so I don't need to charge him the sales tax. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And when you're at 5 to 10% margins, like sometimes a 5 to 10% state sales tax could completely erase that. Yeah, it's everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so that makes sense. So now we've got our first supplier, we placed our test order, we've shipped it off to Amazon. Do we need to do anything? We're kind of piggybacking on an existing listing, or to your point earlier about, well, as I gain more experience, my whole promise, hopefully down the road, is to help brands improve their sales on Amazon. Like, am I making any changes or improvements to the product listing pages? Am I setting up my own listing page? Like, how does that stuff work?
No, so that's the beauty of this model, is we are tapping into existing demand for these brand name products that already exist on Amazon, right? So like I said, there are, well, a lot of brands will not let you sell their products because they want you to bring some sort of value to the table. There are plenty of brands that don't care, right? If you want to place an order, they will sell to you. And all you have to do is hop on their existing listings and start selling those products that people are already buying. So you don't have to spend a dime on ads. You don't have to create any listings. You don't have to do any marketing. You are piggybacking on that existing demand.
Do you have edit access to those pages if you do want to make some improvements? You know, subjective, of course, in everyone's mind, like, hey, I made this better.
There are some listings that you will have the ability to edit, and there are some listings that Amazon won't let you edit. Why that is, I couldn't tell you. What that criteria looks like for what you can edit or what you can't edit, I couldn't tell you. Again, it's all based on like a back-end algorithm that Amazon has. So there have been times where, for example, I'm looking to go sell a product, but maybe that listing is incorrect. Maybe the listing has it as a 2-pack when in reality it's a 3-pack. So I try to go and edit that listing to correct it. And sometimes Amazon will reflect my edit, no problem. It shows up within 10 minutes. Other times, Amazon just will not take the edit and I can't get them to make the change. So in those cases, sometimes I just can't sell the product.
Okay. Huh. So once it's out of your hands and in the warehouse, it sounds like, okay, I'm just piggybacking on these existing listings, especially just starting out. That's it. Now I'm just going to let the algorithms hopefully work in my favor and I don't have to do any additional marketing or sales.
Assuming you're selling FBA, which I highly recommend everybody do, when your products get to Amazon's warehouses, they'll check in. And when they check in, that's when you'll see them live for sale on your seller account. Now from there, the name of the game once the products are in your account is just keeping your pricing competitive. Because like we said earlier, Amazon's main concern is getting customers the best possible price. In order to get sales, you've got to be priced competitively. Now, if you're brand new to Amazon, you've only got a couple of products that you're selling, it's going to be good practice for you to go into your account and make sure that you are always usually the lowest price, right? So you might have to manually go in and adjust your pricing every few hours or once a day or however often you are able to do that. And now once you have more than 10 active products, is my recommendation, once you have more than 10 active products, that's when you would get what's called a repricer. Okay, so a repricer is a software tool that constantly adjusts your pricing to be competitive, keeping you in the buy box and helping you get sales, right? So that way I'm not having to log into my Amazon account every hour and adjust my price by a dollar. My repricer is doing it for me automatically while I sleep, at which point you are literally making sales. Like during this interview, we probably made 10 to 15 sales because my repricer has been adjusting my pricing and Amazon fulfilling my orders. You see?
That's crazy. Just like the speed of turn.
Yeah.
What's kind of interesting is that that isn't built in to Amazon, like on Turo or Airbnb. Like it's all like dynamic, algorithmically based pricing for these dates, these demand. Like it's kind of surprising that they don't, I imagine they do it for their own products, but maybe in Seller Central down the road, like you'll set a price floor that you don't want to go below. And then otherwise you authorize the algorithm to optimize this for you. I'm sure it's coming down the road.
Well, actually Amazon does have a built-in repricer that you can use within your Seller Central account.
Okay.
However, never, ever, ever do that. Because again, Amazon just wants you to make a sale at the lowest price. They don't care about your profit. They don't even know what you bought the product for. So if it was up to them, and this is what I've heard from people that have used their repricer, is they're going to slash your price and you're probably going to lose money. You really want to go with a third-party repricing tool. There are a bunch of great ones out there. The one we use is really high-end. It's very expensive, but it's worth it. It pays for itself. So,
what tool is that?
So the one that we use is called SellerSnap. SellerSnap is one of the highest-end tools. It starts at $500 a month.
So you got to be doing serious volume before that makes sense.
Yeah, but SellerSnap gets us more sales at higher prices. So it pays for itself in our experimentation. It'll pay for itself like within 4 or 5 days a month. Now, there are some more entry-level tools. A great one is Aura, goaura.com. And Aura actually just this week launched. It's almost like a starter program. So normally, I believe Aura is around $97 a month. And they launched a lower tier version of their product that's $27 per month that you can only get if you're doing less than $10,000 a month in sales. So that's actually going to be your best bet by far for a repricer as a new seller. Because $27 a month, there's no other good repricer on the market for that price point, and Aura is really good.
Cool. All right. So now we've come to the finish line. Our stuff is live on Amazon. We've got it dynamically repricing with this tool. And we're making sales. And then hopefully they're profitable sales. And you go back to the same brand or the same distributor again to replenish, if that makes sense. And it's kind of lather, rinse, repeat to try and expand the product line. Do you tend to stay within a category or you kind of take the horse blinders off at a certain point and say, I'm product agnostic. I will go wherever there's margin.
So that product agnostic approach was our approach for a long time. And now it works. There's going to be profitable products in every category on Amazon. However, we found we get a lot more traction a lot quicker when we specialize. So I'll give you an example. We do a lot of tools and automotive products, and it's so much easier for us to get a foot in the door with, let's say, a tool brand or a tool distributor, start doing some business with them, and then going to one of their competitors and saying, hey, we're doing business with XYZ. We're in your category. We know what type of products you carry. We know all about your business. We'd like to work with you as well. And it's such an easier conversation than if I'm doing, let's say I'm selling mainly tools, and then I call up a pet food brand and I say, hey, we'd like to sell your products. And they say, okay, well, what do you guys normally sell? And I list a bunch of tool brands. They're going to be like,
wait a minute.
Okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're like, okay, like that doesn't really make sense. It's way easier to specialize, at least at first, and then expand out from there if you want.
All right. That makes sense. What's the biggest mistake over the last 5+ years of doing this?
So biggest mistake has just been lack of consistency. If I've learned anything in the last, I mean, May will be 7 years of selling on Amazon. Our business does the best when we're consistently buying profitable inventory. So whenever we've taken our foot off the gas and saying like, oh, we can place that order next week, or we'll follow up with that supplier next week, right? That's when things start to slow down and fall off. But when we're proactive, when we're on top of our game, when we're consistently ordering profitable inventory, that's when things continue to grow.
And you mentioned having a couple of VAs helping out with this. Are they helping on that sourcing side, doing the upfront product research and the initial outbound, trying to reach a decision maker?
They're doing all of that. So we've got an admin, Ralph, who does a lot of just the initial outreach. So Ralph will reach out to some of these suppliers and help us get accounts set up, which he's gotten pretty good at. And then once we had the account open, Criselda, who's my head of operations, she's based in the Philippines, she then begins the sourcing process. She'll look at the brands they carry, she'll look at their pricing, and basically present me with a curated list of basically, hey, Corey, this brand has 100 different products. I went through them and these are the five I think we should buy, right? So then my job at that point is just to look at those five and give her the thumbs up, the thumbs down, or hey, let's just change the quantity, right? Because she might have said, well, I think we should buy 100 units. I might say, actually, I think we should buy 50, and this is why.
Okay, as that initial test order.
Yep.
Gotcha. Once you have the systems in place, it seems repeatable and delegatable. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of put yourself in just that decision-making CEO role. Yeah, we're going to buy this, we're going to order this, or you know, I'm going to develop or continue to try and maintain these supplier relationships and get to live the entrepreneur life that you set out to do at the very beginning. Anything else surprising along the way in the Amazon world or elsewhere along your journey?
Yeah, so the biggest surprise was how long it really took to get traction in this business. Now, keep in mind, I started wholesale specifically back in 2019. There were a couple of people putting out content about wholesale specifically at the time. Now, in 2024, there's so much content. So suffice it to say, I was having to learn a lot by trial and error. And I remember specifically year one of wholesale, I said to my dad, who was my business partner, I said, Dad, I think we're going to do well over $1 million in sales this first year. I think we're going to do X, Y, right? I had all these big projections for year one. Come to find out, it took probably about 3 years to do what we thought we were going to do in year one. And there's a really good quote that I think back to a lot along the lines of, you overestimate what you can accomplish in 1 year and you underestimate what you can accomplish in 5 years. And that has been pretty much my journey to a T. I thought year one, we were going to be here. Realistically, it took about 3 years. And then come year five, which we're in year five of wholesale, I finally feel like things are starting to click.
Yeah, there's huge value in sticking with one thing long enough to start to see the compound interest, compound effect of your efforts along the way.
Yep.
And it's like kind of a numbers game. You have to reach out to 100 different suppliers to get maybe five phone calls, to get maybe one yes. And then doing that over and over again and building systems around that. Like you mentioned, the consistency element of it, because it's like, well, once you have one, okay, you've proven the model. And now it's just a matter of stacking other products, other deals, other suppliers on top of that and going to town, multiplying your money, letting it compound, hopefully faster than other investment vehicles. But Corey, this has been awesome. I've learned a ton. It's been a really long time since we talked anything Amazon wholesale related. So this has been really cool to kind of catch up and learn what's working now. But where are you taking this thing? 5 years into it, what's next for you?
My goal with the business, I want to be probably in that like $5 to $8 million per year revenue range with my team running the bulk of the operations, which they kind of already are. So just continuing to scale what it is that we're doing. And now I do, in fact, about a year ago, I started posting content very heavily on Twitter at first. Now LinkedIn and YouTube, my podcast, I've got all these different media outlets that I'm trying to grow as well because I'm super passionate about this business and I do enjoy talking about it and teaching people about how it works. So really growing the content side of my business as well is going to be a big focus of mine moving forward.
Absolutely. That's the Amazon Wholesale Podcast. You find that on wherever fine podcasts are sold. Corey's also got a new book out, The Five Pillars of Amazon Wholesale, which you can find on Amazon, of course. CoreyGannum.com is where you can find him. You can find the podcast and the book over there. We'll link that up in the show notes. Make sure to join his newsletter to get notified of the upcoming wholesale challenge that he runs two or three times a year to get people off the sidelines and into the game. I wanted to ask before we wrap up, your team is running most of the stuff, like you're creating the content. Is that where the bulk of the time is going today? Is kind of like on the public facing, I'm going to become the guy that teaches you how to do wholesale side of things?
Content creation definitely takes the bulk of my time these days. However, in the wholesale business itself, I really try to be focused on the stuff that moves the needle, right? So those tasks that move the needle in my actual wholesale business are supplier relations, right? So just basically calling up my suppliers and making sure they still like me, right? And then it's approving purchase orders.
What is that called? Like, just, hey, every quarter I set a reminder to just, hey, Mike, just checking in, making sure we're still good.
Seriously, like, that's it. Not every quarter, more like once every 10 days or every 2 weeks, right?
Okay.
Sometimes it's a text and just say, hey, how you doing? And sometimes it's a call. Sometimes it's a, like, for example, this weekend I'm going to a trade show and I'm going to be hanging out with two of our biggest vendors there. So just stay on top of mind, just doing the little things, the blocking and tackling that's required to maintain the business. And then, like I said, approving purchase orders, because we make our money when we buy, is going to be the biggest needle mover for me. So I'm making sure I'm spending my time in the Amazon business doing those two tasks mainly.
That's right. You make your money on the buy side. That's some old school Warren Buffett right there. You're a value investor. I'm just investing in product, baby. So
yep.
CoreyGannum.com. Check him out over there. Make sure to grab the book as well. Let's wrap this thing up with your number one tip for Side Hustle Nation.
Be consistent. This doesn't just apply to an Amazon business, but to business in general. Figure out what those one or two things are that really move the needle in your business, like I just mentioned with mine. Figure out what those things are. Set a goal for like daily or weekly actions and hit them every day or every week for weeks, months, and years. Focus on those tasks that move the needle. Do it consistently for 3 to 5 years, and you'll be astonished at what can happen in that period of time.
Yeah, it's funny. A friend of mine had posted this saying, you know, if you want to achieve financial independence in 20 years, invest in low-cost index funds. If you want to achieve financial independence in 10 years, invest in real estate. If you want to achieve financial independence in 5 years, you got to start this business. How do you accelerate it? And I think there's a lot of truth to that. Notes for me, number one, like, start with that toe dip, right? Make sure this is something that you're interested in. Maybe you can learn Seller Central through retail arbitrage, through online arbitrage. Just kind of familiarize yourself with Amazon, with how that works. Do the numbers game, this outreach. Like, if you call 10 people and you get hung up on, like, okay, did you call 100? Did you call 500? Like, there's a certain aspect of persistence here that I think is going to be required. And again, starting with a level of risk that you're comfortable with, and then multiplying that money. I think that's a really kind of exciting way to do it. Like you talked at the very top of the show, hey, 5,000 can turn into six. Six can turn into 7,200, right? Lather, rinse, repeat, and scale up the business from there. Because once you get the systems in place, I think it can turn into something significant, as Corey has shown us. So again, if you're new to the show, I want to invite you to grab your personalized playlist of the side hustles you're most interested in to generate yours. All you have to do is go to hustle.show, answer a few short multiple choice questions, and then you can add those curated episodes to your device. You can learn what works, and you can go forth out into the world and make some more money. Thousands of listeners have already claimed theirs. There's no reason you shouldn't be next. Again, that's hustle.show. Big thanks to Corey for sharing his insight. Thank you so much for tuning in, and thanks for supporting the advertisers that help make this content free for everyone. As always, you can hit up sidehustlenation.com/deals for all the latest offers from our sponsors in one place. Thanks again for supporting the advertisers that support the show. It really does make a difference. That is it for me. If you're finding value in the show, the greatest compliment is to share it with a friend. So fire off a text message. Hey, you got to check this out. Until next time, let's go out there and make something happen. And I'll catch you in the next edition of The Side Hustle Show. Hustle on. As a Side Hustle Show listener, I know you're driven. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. But I also know you can end up hustling and driving yourself into exhaustion, overwhelm, and even burnout if you don't stay anchored to why you're doing it. That's why I want to recommend another podcast that will massively support your side hustle. It's called What Drives You with host Kevin Miller. Kevin's a former pro athlete. He's a lifelong entrepreneur who started 19 different businesses. He's a father of 9 kids, an author, and a mountain adventurer as well. He knows both the glory and the dark side of drive and has devoted his life to helping people who want to drive further, faster, but also enjoy the ride every single day. He brings on today's most influential people in personal and business development to see what drives them and get their guidance on the key ingredients that power our own drive. If you want to fully harness your drive and find peace and fulfillment in the process, go find What Drives You with Kevin Miller wherever you listen to podcasts.